You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hi, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast designed to help you save and improve your marriage no matter where it is. Even if you're at the beginning of a relationship trying to figure out how to make sure you never have trouble, this is the podcast. If you're at the end of a relationship really struggling with how to keep it on track and how to move it forward, how to keep it from falling off the edge, this is also the show for you. This is where you can gain some practical knowledge, some steps, some understandings that'll help you move your relationship forward. And today I have a very special interview for you. My guest is Dr. Roberta Shaler. As the relationship help doctor, Roberta offers urgent and ongoing care for couples and companies around the world. She created the Optimize Institute and Optimize Center in Escondido, California, has been working with people struggling with life issues, including relationships, for over 30 years. Dr. Shaler calms the turbulence of troubled relationships. Relationships in conflict foster fear, frenzy, and friction. She creates the insight, skills, and space for new beginnings and positive reconnections. She offers the insights and pattern-breaking skills that lead to blame-free, game-free, non-manipulative relationships at home and at work. In today's discussion, Roberta and I cover high-conflict relationships, passive-aggressive behavior, and Kaizen for couples, the topic of her latest book. No matter where your relationship is right now, you have something to learn in this interview. Roberta, thank you so much for being here. This is a real pleasure to have you. I'm really excited. I think you've got a lot to share with our listeners. And where I always like to start is how you got to here. What got you interested in working with couples and just kind of your background story about how you got to this place in life?
Well, that's always an interesting question to ask everybody, isn't it? Because that's what we ask our clients. How I got here is I wanted to be a medical doctor, and I was just about to go to medical school, and I found out I was going to start a family instead. And what I loved about considering medical school was I love the idea of helping people first, and secondly, using my skill set to help people see things they can't see, which is the whole situation of figuring out what's going on and what's going wrong. So I shifted into taking a PhD in psychology, and then I looked at the entire world, and I did a lot of things with motivational speaking and writing some books that are motivational, and slowly found that where I really felt my calling was to help couples. And I've previously been divorced and raised my children mostly alone. And so I know what it feels like to really have a lot of hope in a relationship and do all that you can and have it still not work. And I also know what it feels like to meet your soulmate and then have everything work and work out and work through. And now I know from both sides of it how to help people.
Great. You know, what's interesting is a lot of times I find that people come at that because of personal experience. You know, the divorce probably brought to mind how painful it can be to get that to that stuck place in a relationship and not really have a way through. And what you've done is created some ways for couples, even in really kind of high conflict situations, to work through it. So let's talk some about what you see as your expertise and how you help people.
Sure. Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. If you've walked it, you know a lot more about it. I also come from a family, Lee, that people ought to know, too, that we learn so much when we're growing up, all the mirror neurons things and all the things that happen to us. We're picking up how to have a relationship from being in our family. And even though we might know that I never want to have a relationship like my parents had, I may still go out and replicate it at my worst moments, at my most desperate moments. So I come from a family that wasn't very happy, but it was a time when you stuck with it, air quotes, no matter what, and generated a whole deal of misery on everybody, but never got any help. And that always seemed like a crazy thing to me. So yes, high conflict people are of great interest to me, and helping the partners of high conflict people. My mother was a passive aggressive borderline. My father was passive and yet resentful and unhappy all the time. I'm an only child, so I got to sit and watch and listen to all of that. And fortunately and unfortunately, because those two things go together, I had to become their parent in that sense.
Let's go back just a little bit. There's a lot in there that some people might need. So let's define what we mean by, or what you mean by, a high conflict couple. What do you mean by that?
That's where one person's behavior, it's usually one person, occasionally it happens that it's two, but it's rare, where one person really has some personality traits that leave them in a condition of always wanting to be right. Nothing is ever their fault. They're always looking for affirmation and confirmation and taking on no responsibility for the relationship. And these are the times when the other person is really pretzelizing themselves, bending over backward, trying to make a relationship work, second-guessing themselves, questioning their sanity, and they're still saying, I can't make it work. And they don't understand the dynamic that's coming from the personality traits of the other person. So when I wrote the ebook, Stop, That's Crazy Making, How to Quit the Passive-Aggressive Game, it was to help people understand that we have to have great compassion for passive-aggressive or high-conflict people because they came by these things organically. But when it's not working in their relationship, there is a loving and supportive way, a process that I use with them, that they can learn to do things differently and make their life safe together. And so that's what I mean when I'm talking about high-conflict people, people who don't know another way to do it, so they're kind of fighting their way through life and being very demanding. And then their partners are saying, what can I do? What can I do? I love this person, but it seems impossible. So that's a specialty of my work with couples.
Okay, so now we've got another term that's out there, passive-aggressive. Let's talk about the definition for that. What is passive-aggressive?
Passive-aggressive is a defense mechanism that we learn when we're young. It's a way of not wanting to confront anybody. It usually happens to people who are people-pleasers. They turn into people-pleasers, but they say they're going to do something. I'll give you an example, easiest way to understand. I say to my partner, this is all hypothetical, of course, I say to my partner, will you pick up the dry cleaning on Saturday because I have to go out to a speaking gig Monday morning and I really need it? And he says, yeah, sure. And because I know him, I say, are you sure you'll have time? That'll work for you because I really, really need it. Yeah, sure, of course, no problem. So I come home on Saturday night. Where's my dry cleaning? His response is, I have better things to do with my life than go around doing errands for you. So why that's passive-aggressive is that in that example, my supposed husband, who would never do that, says, I don't want the confrontation in this moment, so I agree to do what you want me to do. I will postpone having that conflict in case you forget, and if you don't forget and you call me on it, I'll tell you that you made an unreasonable request. So it's a way of trying to keep himself safe. Right? So it's a learned behavior, but it's a defense mechanism to try and stop any unreasonable or reasonable expectations.
Yeah. And so part of that is that keeping him safe means that he's got the anger. I mean, the anger is in him, but for whatever reasons, he's learned that's not okay. And so instead of expressing it directly, he finds an indirect way that is hard to put on him. It's hard to confront because he'll just say, oh, it slipped my mind, or, you know, how dare you ask me that?
Yes, and when you look at these people who have these behaviors, they're unhappy because they're always living on the edge. They're always living in defensiveness. They're always blaming, and they're always afraid of being shamed. And so this becomes a very, very difficult dynamic for a couple because the other person is likely drawn to it by thinking, what do I need to do to fix this? How can I appease this? How can I nurture this? How can I do something right? Am I really that stupid? Did I really forget to ask? Am I really that thoughtless that I failed to think about his needs? And so the other person becomes overly accommodating and they burn out and they really think that there's something terrible with them. them, and then they start getting really angry. Now we've got two people who are angry and resentful, mm-hmm. and we get an impasse.
Mm-hmm. And that's when the high conflict comes in. They keep going at it in less than constructive ways.
Far less than constructive ways.
Yeah. And so some other ways that someone might show passive aggressive, maybe like sarcasm is one way of being passive aggressive.
Yeah.
Because when you confront somebody on, oh, that was mean what you said, the response is, oh, I was just kidding. Why do you take it so personally? And they've gotten out there. You know, they've gotten their dig in, but not directly.
Yeah. Well, sarcasm, it's a good thing you brought that up because I teach a lot of anger management programs. And sarcasm is a low-level anger response. We're really hoping that we can say what's so for us and we can slide it in there without the other person really having the opportunity to think you weren't kidding, but were you kidding? And then if somebody says something about it, they say, oh, I was just kidding, or mm-hmm. gee, you've got a thin skin.
Right, yeah.
Right? But it is that way of getting that anger expressed, and it's a very low-level anger, and it's a great thing to give up. If you want to improve your life right away, give up sarcasm if it happens to be something you're using in the name of quote-unquote humor.
Right. What are other passive-aggressive kind of behaviors? We've got sarcasm and also that committing to doing something, then not following through. What else?
Yeah, and you brought one up, Lee, which is forgetting. That's a big deal with passive-aggressive people. They will just say they forgot. And if you came to my office, Lee, you would see in big gold letters on the wall, it says the most important thing that I can teach anybody. That's not what it says. It says this. It says, the truth is what you do. And so I help people understand that it's not what you say. When what you say and what you do don't match, I want people to always believe the behavior. So when a passive-aggressive person is always forgetting to do what they said they would do, or not show up at the time they would said they would, or is not there to look after the children when they said they would, whatever it is, and they say, oh, I forgot, that's just one key, one standout phrase that repeats itself over and over with passive-aggressive people.
And so, one piece of that, I think sometimes some people make this kind of a binary thing that we all have points when we forget to do something, that we genuinely forget. And that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a pattern of behavior where the person, it's not that it slipped their mind that they needed to pick up potato chips at the store, but, they forgot to pick up the kids at daycare, and it comes on the heels of an argument about who's responsible for the kids or something like that. I mean, it's more than just day, it slipped my mind. It's a pattern.
Yeah, it's definitely a pattern, and it's not just the fact you were stressed that day.
Yeah. And one of the things it does show, whenever we forget something, what it does demonstrate it at a bare minimum is that it wasn't something that we put a lot of importance into.
Exactly.
If it's not passive aggressive, it still says something.
Well, here's another example. I was teaching a class, and here in sunny San Diego, people were waiting outside in the evening because it's nice and warm. And I'm walking to teach the class, and this woman, who was rather expressive and loud, she yelled out, she said, I didn't come last week. Sorry, I meant to. And I yelled back, no, you didn't. And there was a stunned silence, And as I got closer, she said, yeah, I really meant to come. I said, no, you didn't mean to come. And when we got into the room, she said, well, what are you talking about? And I ended up actually recording a talk on the subject after that. And what I said is, meaning to is meaningless.
Mm. Yeah.
Because when it is that pattern of, oh, I meant to, that's supposed to be some way that lets you off the hook, or that you didn't do what you said you would do. And that's another example of passive-aggressive behavior, is just saying, oh, well, I meant to, I really did, forgive me, forgive me, forgive me. But if it's a pattern, then we have to look at it as for what it is.
Okay, so let's bring in one other piece. You use the label passive-aggressive, and you also use the label passive. So passive is another pattern, and it's mm-hmm. not the same as being laid back, because someone who's laid back really is okay with what's going on. Passive is a little bit different.
Yeah, passive is when I want to get my needs met indirectly. I don't want to say what I want or say what I need or ask for what I want or need. I want you to figure it out. Here's an example. What would you like to do on your birthday? Oh, I don't know. Birthday comes, partner does what they do, it's not good enough. Well, hey, what did you expect? You just said, oh, I don't know. I had a client, another good example. She was leaving a session. I said, have a good week. She said, oh, I will. It's my birthday. I said, great. What are you going to do? She said, well, in the best of all worlds, my husband would remember, and he'd bring me flowers, and he'd take me out to dinner, and he'd bring me a gift that had nothing to do with the house. I said, that sounds great. Did you tell him? She said, no. And then she said that phrase that often comes out of women's mouth, that never should. And she said, if he really loved me, he'd know what I want. So I said to her, do you love your husband? She said, yeah. I said, well, then tell him what you want for your birthday. Tell him what would flip your skirt and float your boat and let him have a chance to show up. And she said, oh, I said, that's how you show your love your husband. You give him a chance to succeed. So she came in the next week. I said, how's your birthday? She said, well, he remembered and he brought flowers and he brought me a gift. And I said, great, what happened? She said, I opened it. It was an electric fry pan and he asked me what was for dinner. I said, you didn't tell him, did you? She said, no. I said, well, then you got the birthday he asked for.
Yeah.
It was a huge lesson, but that's passive. Like, I'm not going to tell you what I want, but I want you to be a mind reader and figure it out, and I'll make you wrong when you don't give it to me, or I will feel that I don't deserve it anyway when you didn't give it to me, and I will take on it on internally.
So there's at least two pieces to this passive. One is I don't want to have a conflict, so I'm not going to bring this up, which a lot of people have. And then there's the I'm not going to bring it up because you ought to know, and that's how you prove your love.
Yes, and then there's a third part. I'm not going to bring it up because I don't want to risk you not doing it, and then I'll feel even worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I'm not going to test whether or not I'm important enough to ask for what I want, and I'm not mature enough to hear you say yes or no. See, that's a big thing, I think, in relationships, and I'm sure in your work you find it all the time, as I do, that grown-ups who have a relationship, and I make a distinction between grown-ups and adults. Adults are just a stage of growth, like baby, toddler, preschooler, high schooler, college student, adult. You just got bigger. But emotional grown-ups have actually matured into a situation where when your partner asks for something or you ask your partner for something, you can actually hear yes or no, and you can honor that, and you can have a conversation about it without feeling like your partner should give you everything you ask for or do everything you want them to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's another piece of the passive game.
And one of the other pieces I think you put out there is that there are these patterns we learn in childhood. Let's talk a little bit more about that, what we bring out of our families of origin, the families we grew up in. How does that happen? What do we learn and what do we do with that?
Oh, that's such a broad topic, Lee. But, you know, things happen. And, you know, there's no blame in this. I just want to be clear. I think you would agree with me on this. It's not about looking for blame. It's about looking for understanding. Where did I come by these patterns? Where did my partner come by these patterns? And I can be in a home, for instance, where there's alcoholism. I'm going to learn that my life is unpredictable. I'm going to learn, perhaps, if it's severe, that I have to be hypervigilant. I have to be on edge all the time, trying to figure out what's going on and try not to make somebody angry, for instance. And that never gets resolved when I'm in my youth and growing up in that household. And then I come into a relationship, and now I bring that, and I put all that I learned right on the face of my partner. And I start behaving with my partner like, you're unpredictable and I don't know what to do and I don't know a way around. And I bring that fear and that concern and that lack of self-esteem within myself and that lack of self-confidence. And I behave with my partner that way. And I've already prejudged the relationship that it's going to be like it was. If there's any tension at all, it's going to be the same way it was when there was tension with my parents.
Yeah. I think the fact is that whatever we saw in our family, we assume that's the way it's done. You know, it's just kind of our built-in assumption that whatever we saw, and a lot of times when we get away, we kind of realize that's not the case. But there are still those pieces that when we get into a relationship, just pull us back to what we cut our teeth on.
Absolutely. And that's what's going to happen, because when we get into an anxiety situation, and I hope everybody listening knows this, and if you don't, it's very important information, that there's a level of arousal that comes in our bodies. Whether, like when I'm teaching anger management, I'm talking about it in those terms, but it's the same level of arousement, whether it's fear or whatever going on. And the body wants to survive. The body is a survival mechanism. So it immediately wants to make sure that it keeps the heart and lungs going, and it starts drawing blood from the extremities. One of those extremities is our head. So it starts taking blood from there. Our prefrontal lobes are the centers of reason and logic. We're slowly draining blood from that to keep ourselves alive. The body thinks it has to do that. So now here we are in the middle of an argument, or we're having some high fear, or something's going on, and we say these things. We make justifications. We feel so righteous, and we say and do things from that point of view, and we're partly brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that even if we don't say anything because of our fear, perhaps, we're still going through that. And that's the beingness that we are with our partner. And that's a terrible situation to be in, because we're not fully functioning. So if our home has taught us to be fearful of situations, and with anything that looks like or feels like the way we have learned, as you say, that our parents taught us the way it is, then we respond to that autonomically. Right. We don't stop and think about it. This is the way we've learned for 18 years. So there's no thought process. We just jump into that, and that's not good for us in a new relationship.
And a lot of those patterns, I think are locked in when we're pre-verbal, because that part of our brain is also pre-verbal. And so when we get to that escalation point, you know, there's this part of us, our brain, that may, at the beginning at least, be arguing about what's going on in our head. But there's that other part that's a little more primitive, that lasts a little longer through the blood flow loss, that remembers how to do fight and flight, just like our family did. And so we often find those repetitive patterns that our parents did, their parents did, and their parents before them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, as you say, we're pre-verbal. So during the time we're pre-verbal, if you know about the more recent brain research, we have things called mirror neurons. So here we are taking in all these patterns and ways of being and how things feel. And we think, that's what I should be mirroring to the world, right? It's being mirrored in us, and then I become that. And until we become self-reflective and willing to examine ourselves, we may never notice that we're just repeating patterns that we consciously or subconsciously perhaps hated while we were experiencing them, and yet here we are, the perpetrator of that very experience over and over again, and we're also the author of our experience over and over again. So when couples get into huge conflict, or they're on the verge of, as you say, needing to save the marriage, they're at that place where they're the worst of their parents, seeing and fighting the worst of their parents, right? And I did some videos recently with Harville Hendricks and the Imago Therapy people, and, you know, with him talking about, we attract a partner who is going to be what we unconsciously or subconsciously haven't dealt with our parents. And there we are.
Yeah.
The fight is on.
And that's the thing that a lot of people kind of think, that they've made a conscious effort to avoid marrying a parent. And what I like about Harville Hendricks' theory is that it's the unfinished pieces. It's not like we married the exact image, but it's the unfinished pieces that we find in the other person, whether they're actual or not. We create that image of them. We kind of fit it back in there. And that's an important piece, because that's also the path to healing.
Exactly. But, you know, just imagine for ourselves and for everyone listening, how open we have to be to looking at ourselves and our patterns, not with any blame or shame, but just let me look at it. Let me become curious about it. Let me investigate it. Not that, you know, if I have come to a place in a relationship where I don't feel like I can expose myself in any way, I'm not going to feel happy looking for those places within myself, because I'm still in a defensive mode. But when we really want to save our marriage, the first place we have to look is within ourselves. Like, who am I and what am I doing and what am I contributing to this? Mm. You know, when I wrote Kaizen for Couples, I talk about how here are the things you need to look at and what's going on within you and how that's expressing in the relationship. And so many times people come in and or they're online, because I have people all over the world, thank heaven for the internet, and they've got these bubbles over their head in their first session, and each bubble reads, my relationship would be great if you just fixed him or her, right?
Yeah.
And we have that defensiveness that it's all about the other person. Well, it isn't, of course. We're all in it, and hopefully we're all in. And that's the other thing that I write about. We have a great deal of support in our world right now for what I call a hokey-pokey relationship. You got one foot in and one foot out, and that's what it's all about, right? And your friends are saying, oh, well, you deserve better than that. You just leave him. He doesn't treat you well. And for that reason, when people come to work with me, I make them make a pact. For the time we're working together, you are only going to talk to each other and me about your relationship. You may not talk to anybody else, because people in their relationships use their friends for support, and those friends have a vested interest in your relationship, and they want you to take their advice, and they may or may not even have anything worthwhile or positive to say.
Yeah.
And so it's very important when you want to save the marriage to really look at who am I being and how am I being, and be willing to be safe with each other in that exploration, and then how will we do this better going forward?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I've had so many people say, in fact, I just had an email this morning from a person saying, yeah, there's nothing I can do. My friends tell me I need to give up. My friend tells me it's not my fault. I mean, they pull all, it's basically trying to get a straw poll from everybody that's going to agree with them anyway. You know, there's not going to, who do you ask? It's somebody who's going to agree with you. We don't go seek people out that are going to disagree with us. They're not our friends, and our family's going to back us up. And so what we end up doing is getting a unanimous vote that's exactly what we're already thinking, rather than going, where is it that I am responsible for this? And able to respond is how I use that. You know, responsible is that ability to respond. Am I able to respond to this differently?
Yes, and I agree with you. And then there's the other piece of that friend who's giving the advice wants you to take their advice because it validates them.
Yeah.
And doesn't contribute to the relationship at all, just pulls you over to their side a little more and pulls you away from your partner.
Yeah.
Like, what's with that?
Yeah.
And what's with us for allowing that, right? Because if you really want to have a life, you have to figure out you. Like, I talk a lot about each one of us is given the opportunity of a lifetime. That means it's our opportunity to experience and express who we are, what our values, vision, purpose, and belief is, unique from every other person on the planet, and figure it out and express it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm not doing that, I'm not experiencing my life. I'm living to the expectations of others. My husband and I wrote a book called Soul Solitude, Taking Time for Our Souls to Catch Up. And we talk about two predicaments in there. There are lots more, but two main predicaments. And the first one is living up to the expectations of others. Mm. If you're living up to the expectation of your friend, to use your example, because they think you should leave the relationship and they think you deserve better and they think he's a loser or she's a tramp or whatever, you're living up to the expectation of your friend and you've now forgotten the person you committed your life to.
Yep.
What's up with that? Like, let's get it straight. Where are our priorities?
It is interesting how many the mind games we play to self-validate what we, you know, what we're thinking, and then, you know, interject ourselves into other people's opinions is just a dangerous thing. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this high conflict piece, because Yeah, to me, if you grew up in that and you know that there's something up with your relationship, you may not be clear about what that is. It's kind of like saying to a fish, hey, you realize you're swimming in water. They probably don't at that point until you point it out. So what are some signs that a couple is one of those high conflict couples? Because there are some couples that really are falling apart. It's just that they're not high conflict. They're just low connection.
Absolutely. So making that distinction once again, because I think you made a really good one, we're all going to be somebody's idea of a difficult person on some days at some time.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking with high conflict people. There's somebody there who is difficult every day or almost every day, right? There's something difficult about it. So an example would be that it's never there. The high conflict person never takes responsibility for anything. It is never their fault. No matter what's going on, there's always someone else to blame. So that's a hallmark of a high conflict person.
Okay.
Is that it's always somebody else's fault.
I'm taking notes so we can put this in the notes. Keep going.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you think you're in relationship with a high conflict person, go to highconflictmanagement.com. That's one of my websites. And there are 12 traits listed on the homepage.
Okay.
If you have 8 of them, that's what you're dealing with.
We'll put that link in the notes.
Okay. So first of all, it's never my fault. Secondly, I have to win. Okay, if that means that I say white is white and you say, oh yeah, you're right, white is white, I'm okay. But if we have a conflict, I am going to say no, you know, white is white and that's the way it has to be. And if you don't think white is white, then you're wrong, mm-hmm. right? They have to be right. And if they can't be, they immediately change from 180 degree flip because they are going to be right. So if it means I have to change my mind and start arguing for the other side in order to be right, they will do it. And it's crazy making behavior. You know, that's why I have a website at crazymaking.com with a hyphen in it, because high conflict traits and passive aggressive people are crazy making to us, mm-hmm. because we just don't know what to think about it. So it's never my fault and I always have to win. There's two high conflict pieces. Then if when I talk to you, you keep changing your story, then there's a high conflict piece there, because that need to win starts to show up as I will keep changing my story until we are in accord with each other and you have come over to my side, which is a big problem. And when you're in relationship with a high conflict person, like I said earlier, you start to really second guess yourself. Did I say that? Did I have that tone of voice? Was I unreasonable? Did I fail to do something? You start really questioning yourself. And particularly when the dynamic is as the man is a high conflict person and the woman is not. The reason for that, because we're hardwired. The woman is hardwired to nurture, so she keeps trying to take this man as though he's a plant, and if I put him in the window, will he be happier? Will he be happier in a dark corner? Do I need to change the light? Do I need to change the heat? Do I need to change the soil? Do I need to water less? Do anything at all to nurture? And there is no way to nurture that. So it really becomes a difficulty. And of course, there's other things in the reverse. But it's so crazy-making when you start to have to second-guess yourself all the time and your self-esteem starts to go down and down and this other person becomes more and more demanding because their need to be right is so ingrained. And so those are some ways of looking at high-conflict people.
Okay.
And high-conflict patterns. And I don't like labels, Lee. I don't think it does any good. I think if you need it for forensic purposes, perhaps it's useful to have a psychological label or a diagnosis of any kind. But I prefer to talk about traits and patterns. And if these traits and patterns are existing, then you may well be in a high conflict situation and it needs special handling. And that's where I spend my time. Another thing that you can see as a symptom of a high conflict relationship is that if you divorce a high conflict person, it's not over. In fact, it may never be over because of the need to win. Mm-hmm. I have worked with people who have been divorced for 12 years, and I think of one case where the man was very high conflict, and he had moved on, married somebody else for 5 years. She was still getting 10 to 15 emails a day.
Yeah.
Right? So these are examples of high conflict behaviors. If someone won't leave you alone after you've said no, I don't want the relationship anymore, you may well be with a high conflict person. They may be needy, but they also may be high conflict.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's say somebody says, okay, I've got those, whether they are listening to what we just said or went to the website. What are a couple of first steps they can do? I don't think it's possible to say, you know, here's the three hints that are going to get you finished. But what's a starting point? How can they begin to manage that? I have some thoughts, but I want to hear yours too.
Sure. Well, I'd love to talk about it with you. The first thing that I think I help people do, or that I would invite them to do on their own if they can, is to start looking at the dividing line between what's my partner's and what's mine. Right? Like, do I behave that way? No. My partner behaves that way. Is it reflected in me? Am I now sucked into it? Mm-hmm. Am I now mirroring it back?
Yeah.
So the first thing is to get clear about who owns what in the emotional landscape of the relationship. And then to start looking at your own behavior to see how you're contributing to it in any way. Because it always starts with us. Mm-hmm. Let's do our own work first. And then to get clear, what are my values, vision, and beliefs and purpose? And am I actually demonstrating and living them in the relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any adjustments that I need to make to come clean with that alignment of my values, vision, beliefs, and purpose, then do that. Do your own work first. Don't come in with the blame and the upset and just, you know, I can't stand it any longer. You may start there, but the first thing I'm going to invite somebody to do is to do their own work.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondarily, start looking at the patterns of behavior as opposed to the person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are the patterns that I'm seeing. I want us to be compassionate for high conflict people and passive aggressive people. They're not doing that on purpose. They learned how to do that. They learned from their parents. They learned from the situations in which they were that these are the defense mechanisms they need in order to survive. It's deeply ingrained, organically ingrained. And so they're not out to get you and all of that. They don't know another way. Now, that doesn't mean you have to put up with it. Don't get me wrong. There are ways to modify your response, and there are ways to look for modifications in the relationship. But do start out by knowing, sifting and sorting what's mine, what's theirs, what are the patterns, and making a clear list of where you engage repeatedly and things that go south. Right.
I think that's so important. There is that a substantial difference between empathy and acceptance. You can have empathy for where that person came from without
yes.
having to accept that as how you're treated. My big thing, and some people ask me along the way, when I wrote Save the Marriage, I have a whole chapter on boundaries. And some people are like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, your whole theory is how to create a we, how to be this unit. Why do you have a thing about boundaries? And my response is because if you don't know where you end and how you want to be treated, you can't really step into being a we. You can be an ego mass. You can kind of be a group think, but you can't create what I really mean by a healthy we. Not only that, but you can't reduce the conflict unless you say to somebody, it's not okay for you to treat me that way.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you 100%. Boundaries are important in every way. If we don't have boundaries, our life is just going to be a sloppy mess. Everybody's going to be treating us like a doormat and walking all over us, and we're going to be resentful and angry all the time, whether that's with the mail delivery person, your boss, or your partner,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So it's healthy to have boundaries just because you breathe. And it's not because you're lacking in a willingness to have a relationship and work things out. It's presenting a whole person to your partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you need to be doing that.
And, you know, one of the things that just I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what these boundaries are. And so my quick definition of a boundary is what you will not let someone do to you. And I always feel like I have to explain one other piece when I say boundaries, because it's easy for it to become kind of a manipulation. I was teaching a series on boundaries, and it was the second week, and this woman charged up to me. You know, you always know you're in trouble with that. That person's beelining towards you, and you just like, oh, here it comes. And she said, your boundary thing didn't work. And I said, what do you mean it didn't work? And she said, I did it to my husband, and he didn't change. And I said, you don't do a boundary to somebody. You do it for yourself. And
exactly.
Them changing is not the point. The point
yes.
is you're not going to be mistreated.
Exactly. Yeah. And if we don't get that, then we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Because you don't know who you are.
Right.
You don't know where the edges are. A boundary is the edge between acceptable and unacceptable. Right? This is okay with me. This is not okay with me. And that's the boundary. Mm-hmm. And I need to be able to know it and express it in a non-threatening way, in a factual way. This is okay with me. This isn't okay with me. Could you honor that? You know? And many people don't have boundaries. They think that you're just supposed to be this receptor for what anybody ever wants.
Mm-hmm.
And if we come from a home where there's dysfunction or there's alcoholism or there's any number of things going on, maybe high conflict traits, and you partner with you emotionally partner with the parent who's oppressed, you've got issues around boundaries because you don't think you deserve to take up space and make clear who you are and what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, we go back to my birthday metaphor. If you don't think you deserve to ask for what you want, then you get into that horrible passive place of, if you really loved me, you'd know what I want. And that's disempowering like crazy. So let's not go there. Right?
Yeah. So one piece of this is teaching someone how to treat you. That's a key trait, not waiting for them to treat you that way. One of my comments I often make to people is, your boundaries are up to you to define. They're not for the other person to figure out. If somebody violates your boundary and you don't protect it, that while it's sad and you wish they would do differently, it's not their bad. It's your bad for not having set that boundary.
Exactly. But how many people live like that?
Yeah.
I mean, what's your experience? My experience is that until somebody comes to class, whether they're coming to a relationship class or they're, you know, to get their relationship in better order, or they're just coming to learn how to experience and express themselves more fully in the world, that's the first step. Mm-hmm. Is who are you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think in Soul Solitude, we wrote about these four things. You need to know you're living a myth or a story. You need to know the story you're living. You need to know the story you'd like to live. And then you need to live the story you want.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And if we just take the story that was handed to us and then judge the entire world by that story, we're limiting ourselves terribly. We're not experiencing and expressing all that we could be, and we're certainly not experiencing and expressing our uniqueness. And we have to value ourselves enough to go on that journey of finding out who we are and what we want, and then we all have some sense of where our boundaries are, and then learn some skills to express those boundaries in a way that somebody else can hear, not in a threatening way or an or else way, but here's where it is. And I think that's another thing that happens with couples, and I would guess you have the same experience, is just being able to say in a non-threatening, non-angry way, here's where I end and you begin.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Right? Everything is not a bone to be pulled on by both ends by the partners. Sometimes you can sit down and look at the bone and say, well, what do you think?
And I think that a lot of times people underestimate the capacity of change because they look at the dance that they do with their spouse, and it's not the dance they look at, but their spouse. You know, that dance is their fault.
And exactly.
When they begin to manage their dance steps, when they change how they're doing it, suddenly the other person responds, partly because if you really are setting your boundaries very clearly, the other person has no other choice but to respond differently. And that
That's
begins
right.
to create a new dance.
It begins to create a new dance. And if you are open and grown up and whole, you will look with interest and intrigue about learning more about your partner. Oh, really? Why do you think that? Tell me more about that. Let me learn you.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm in a place of feeling threatened, well, you've never been like that before. Where, you know, I don't let my partner grow. I'm in a dangerous place anyway.
You okay. know, this seems like a really good crossover point as we talk about teaching a spouse how to dance differently to your new book. You mentioned it, Kaizen for Couples. And I love the title. I've always talked about Kaizen for personal development, how you're always yeah. in a kind of a continual improvement, that there are radical improvement points, and then there are the continual improvement points. And there's a lot more continual improvements than radical. But you applied it to couples. So talk
yes.
some about how a couple – and first, let's talk some about Kaizen as the theory going back to Edward Deming and kind of the continual improvement for manufacturing. But you're bringing it into not just kind of the business world, but how couples do life.
Yeah. I think, like you said, I mean, I have – programs called Conscious Kaizen and Relationship Kaizen that work in the workplace as well as at home. And Kaizen, the actual words Kai and Zen, Kai means good and Zen means change. So we want to be making good changes, and taking it from the manufacturing model, we want to make small incremental improvements and then figure out if they were improvements, and if they were, keep them and build on them, and if it wasn't a good improvement, then let that go and figure it out again. Yes. And that's what we have to do to stay in constant dialogue with our partners. And you know as well as I that dialogue and arguing are two completely different things. So people don't have what I call the relationship dialogues. They're not sitting down and talking with each other with an interest to know beyond infrastructure. Like, I want to know how you're feeling about your life, not what you did today. I want to know how that struck you or how that impacted you or did it cause you any questions, as opposed to, well, what time do I need to pick up the kids?
Mm-hmm.
We have to have that time. And if we don't, then we're not going to have the ability to make these small incremental changes. And in Kaizen for Couples, I've got some diagrams in there about how to have an incrementally building conversation. And it requires spending time with each other. I remember a couple who came to me, and they came, you know, week after week, and finally one week their thing I learned, I said, now you need to sit down four times this week for a half hour only and go to the second level conversation, not what happened today, but how do you feel about what happened today. They came back in 2 weeks, and I asked them how it went, and they said, we didn't have time for that. Okay, so let's just look at that. You didn't have time, half an hour, four times a week. You could not find 4 hours in 2 weeks to be together in those small increments. Tell me that you care about each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I could give you all the techniques in the world, but if you're not willing to put the time in, I can't help you. So Kaizen for Couples gives you a structured way of doing things. I'm sure, you know, your work is a system. This is a system. Like, do these things, and it will move you incrementally forward in a positive way, or at least in an enlightening way. So you will learn more about each other. Maybe there are insolvable things between you. And then you come to that question you brought up earlier of acceptance. Can I accept that because 80% of what's going on is great, this thing over here, not so great. Is it a deal breaker? Is it not a deal breaker? But first of all, I have to know about myself. So Kaizen for Couples invites you and gives you structured things to do to learn about yourself and then be able to talk about those things with your partner. And then I offer the 6 relation steps. Here are the 6 things that you have to walk around all the time in your relationship. You know, you've got to have mutuality. You have to be otherwise. You have to be willing to learn about your partner. All the things that are there. And so this leads you through. And that's why the subtitle of the book is Smart Steps to Save, Sustain, and Strengthen Your Relationship. You know, whether it's on the brink of disaster, whether it's become humdrum and nobody's really interested, nobody's really hurt, but nobody's really excited either, or that you know you've got something good and you want to find out how good it can be.
So there are a couple of built-in assumptions behind that. And one of them is that people are a work in progress. And relationships exactly. are a work in progress. And I think sometimes, I mean, I think in some ways we could all say, well, that's obvious. And yet in other ways, I see people who don't live their lives that way. That, you know, why have you changed now? There's a built-in assumption that we're not always changing, you know, when I hear that phrase. And I think a lot of times people say, well, I can grow, I can change, but my spouse won't.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And so it's okay for me.
Right. So we're willing to apply the growth potential, at least to us. But I've seen people who just believe that there's just no growth potential. That, you know, once you're married, there's the relationship. It's where it is. I remember talking with some premarital couples, and I said, you know, what you're doing now is in the business world called having a minimally viable product. You have the starting point, and if you assume that you've now got it, then you don't recognize the fact that you're always trying to add on features. You're testing things out, and some things you go, okay, that didn't work for us. And instead of saying that you did that wrong, you say that's not it for us, and you seek something out. And so the Kaizen method is kind of that cycle of let's look at something we could change. Let's try it out. How did that go? Do we want to keep it?
Yes. What you said, there's so much there. Look, we have to realize this is a living, growing organism. And what I call it is the duct tape conversation. When you meet somebody and you're learning them in the beginning, you kind of make this duct tape outline of them on the floor like the police do to outline a dead body. And then you say, I know you. I know you. I know where your duct tape outline is. And then you put an arm or a leg outside the duct tape. And I say, that's not you. You don't behave like that. I know you better than that. I know you better than you know yourself.
Right.
And then where's the growth?
Yeah.
Right? And so we have to give up the duct tape, right?
And we have to give somebody the possibility that they're going to grow. They're going to step up to the new place, and they're going to join us in that process. That's what I like about that, the Kaizen approach. And so one piece I think is important is that approach could be applied by somebody. Somebody could risk it, could get your material, read through it, and say, you know what, I'm going to risk that second level. We're not going to wait until we agree to have a second level conversation. I'm going to risk a second level conversation by saying, well, how do you feel about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And then there, I'm going to risk being bombarded with things I don't know what to do about. And I'm going to risk hearing the truth about me, yeah. You know, and all that kind of thing. But what I feel really importantly is that they learn how to do what I call in the book, the personal weather report. And that makes it safer.
Hmm.
How to deliver a personal weather report and how to respond to a personal weather report. And that's a key piece for everybody in life, whether you're in a relationship or not, to learn about the personal weather report.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a non-threatening way of communicating and demonstrating your self-knowledge. So we want to look after the safety feature there and make sure that one person's willing to go to the next level, but they have to have some skill to go there, mm-hmm. and they have to have some willingness to hear whatever when they get there.
Mm-hmm. great advice. Just as we're beginning to wrap up, let's talk some about how people can connect further with you. I'm going to put the link to Amazon for the book, for Kaizen for Couples, and so it'll be easy to find. But let's talk some more about how to find you and how to learn more about your process.
Sure. Well, I'm the Relationship Help Doctor, so you'll find me at relationshiphelpdoctor.com. And that's my main site where you'll find everything about how to work with me, how to take a class, how to buy a product, because I've mentioned also the ebook on Stop That's Crazy Making, How to Quit the Passive Aggressive Game, and there are lots of other things there and audio. I've written 10 books, so there's lots there for people. And also, again, that if you are experiencing or wondering if you're experiencing a high conflict situation, go to highconflictmanagement.com. So when you go there, you will be directed to the Optimize Center, which is my brick and mortar business here in Escondido, California, which is in San Diego County. And we can work together in person here in my office. You can come to a class, or we can work together online through Skype or through Google Hangouts or Zoom. I have clients all over the world because of the magic of the internet, and it allows us to see each other just like we're sitting here. And so that's how people can find me. I also have a biweekly newsletter called Tips for Relationships. You can sign up for that. If you're wondering if the person you're in relationship with is passive-aggressive, you can take my free passive-aggressive checklist. That's at passiveaggressivechecklist.com. What a surprise. If you're wondering about the condition of your relationship and you want to figure it out, you can go to relationshipchecklist.com. That's, again, a free online checklist that'll give you a little temperature reading of what's really going on in your relationship. Because if you're in that middle group that we were just discussing, where it's not really terrible, it's not really great, but we think we're just going to mutually ride out whatever this is, you may be living in the what I call the comfortably uncomfortable zone, right? Not bad enough to leave, not good enough to stay, and you're just kind of doing the cha-cha back and forth.
So let me just plug in for that, just because of that case, that, you know, that's going back to the Kaizen where it got into business. The Japanese automakers were the ones who actually understood what Deming was saying. It wasn't that there weren't autos being made in the U.S., but they were kind of chugging along and you know, having some problems that they've now fixed, but that were having some problems. And when the Japanese figured out that we could incrementally improve the models, that's when they ate the market, because they weren't stuck with, well, this is good enough. They went, how can we make this exceptional?
Yes, and you know, he was well known as an innovator for that very reason, because he said the status quo is not what it has to be. Mm-hmm. We can make small incremental improvements. We don't have to make a leap. See, that's why I called the book Kaizen for Couples. It's not like, now you all have to change. Mm-hmm. Like, both of you have to change and you've got to make a complete about face. No, you've got to put these things in slowly so that you can adapt them and adopt them and make sure they become part of the process. And then you take another step and another step. And pretty soon you're going, hey, this is getting pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so it's not about fix me, fix my partner. It's about the relationship, the dynamic, and the fact that that dynamic is not static.
It's always growing.
Yes.
Great.
Yes. If you leave the space for it to grow.
Yeah, and are willing to be a part of that growth process.
Yeah, you've got to suck up your fear and jump in, you know.
That's a great place for us to leave it. All those links we'll put in the notes. And Roberta, thank you so much for being here. We're going to have to get back together and chat some more. But this is a great place for us to put a pause for now, and we can revisit this another time. Thank you for being here.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you, Lee.
It was great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.